This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, The Piper at the Gates of Dawn, anthropomorphic animals in speculative fiction.
So again, I'm surprised that in all of our conversation about speculative fiction, this isn't a subject that we've breached.
No, we've talked about the animal companion, and we've talked about like various different animals in folklore, but we've never looked at books and films and things where the animals are actually the main characters, and the human presence, if there is any, is very marginal, and they're usually off-screen.
Yeah. Now, usually books or media which involve animals as the main characters tend toward younger readers. You may very occasionally get it in YA, but for the most part it appears in middle grade and below. That isn't always the case, but I think the majority of what we're going to be talking about today is in that area.
Yeah, actually I'd kind of disagree slightly, because that is shifting, and there are lots of examples of certainly books where the protagonists are animals, and they were originally intended for adults. I think the problem is that this dates back to sort of the when you were writing in the 60s and 70s, if you were writing fantasy, you were writing for children by default, even if you weren't writing for children and you wanted it to be for adults.
Yeah.
And some of that even hung over into the 80s. So things like, let's put George Orwell's Animal Farm, for instance, isn't actually designed for children, and yet it's kind of marketed that way.
Yeah, okay, that's definitely a very good example. I think in general it tends to be the case, but as you say, it's not an explicit rule. And we do have some very, very fine examples where that isn't the case, and definitely George Orwell's Animal Farm, which is it's a barely veiled metaphor, but it's not even veiled. It's just...
No, it's just a political metaphor. Satire. It's political satire with animals. Anyway, so in these sort of stories, as I've said, excuse me a moment. frog in my throat.
Hebble?
Hebble, yeah. Hebble, obviously. Hebble! I don't groom myself with my tongue.
Man, our listeners don't know.
God. Anyway, as I was saying, in these stories, the humans may have some sort of impact, but they're generally off-screen. They're distant, inexplicable, almost godlike figures that the animals have learned to fear and avoid, and they don't really take part in the conflict of the main thrust of the story. So while they may add complications in the same way that a storm or a volcano would add complications, they're not really protagonists in their own right. They're not antagonists in their own right. They're more like forces of nature, and that's how the animals sort of file them.
Yeah. I mean, and in some cases you have humans not even existing at all, and it is a society simply of animals. And there are a few very, very rare cases where the narrative between the human and the animal, whom both live in very set, and you know, those instances are quite rare. But I think a good example is probably Ratatouille, where obviously the main story is following this rat.
It's also following the chef, though, and he is human.
It is, yeah. But in that case, it's this kind of 50-50 divide. So occasionally we get those kinds of stories where both are the main character. But we're mostly today going to just be focusing entirely when the animals are the only main characters.
Yeah. And that's the thing that's interesting, because these books where it's just let's look at the German term Umwelt. Mm-hmm. Umwelt is used in cognitive biology and zoology, basically to describe a single organism's selfish viewpoint. So you've heard the expression that if you judge an elephant's ability to climb a tree, judge its intelligence by its ability to climb a tree, then you're going to think an elephant is stupid, ditto a fish, etc. When in fact, what people aren't taking into account when they do intelligence tests for animals and work out relative animal IQ, the fascinating subject in its own right, is the fact that obviously an elephant's worldview includes a trunk. It includes an appendage that it can pick things up and put in its mouth or spray water over its back. That's something we don't have. So by the elephant's viewpoint, humans aren't very intelligent because we don't have an appendage hanging from our faces that does this.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say we can pick things up.
But not with our noses. Well, most of us not with our noses. I don't know.
Well, yeah. If there's anyone out there listening today.
that's interesting. But what it basically says, this whole idea of an animal's umwelt, is the fact that we have to infer what an animal thinks and feels. We don't actually know. And basically that's anthropomorphizing. That's attaching human feelings and motivations to an animal. Yeah. Now, that's purely scientific. If I was to say, you know, well, I know when my cat is looking at me and thinking about doing something that will piss me off, you know, because anyone who lives with an animal, it's different. It genuinely is. She knows when I'm annoyed with her, or she knows by doing a certain set of actions that she can get me to pay attention to her, to pick her up, feed her, whatever. And she knows that she can just get into my lap and push a book out of the way. I try not to, but you know, this isn't just learned behavior. Sometimes I swear I can see her sort of thinking around something, and it's not in a human way, it's in a cat way, but she's thinking about how to get what she wants. However, you can argue that I'm inferring that, and I'm anthropomorphizing my cat.
Absolutely.
And with all these books, a lot of them, the animals are given very, very human characteristics. And that's what makes them really interesting. I think that's also what makes these books really appealing to both children and adults, and why some of them have become great classics, is the fact that you're telling an entire story with animals and with an animal perspective. You're leaping over the anthropomorphic divide and giving the animals human feelings and thoughts.
Yeah, and you can take that to several levels. And which level you take it to will often dictate what kind of story you're telling. For instance, giving animals clothes.
Yep.
The idea of giving them tools such as swords or books or anything like that. And actually, and this is going to sound crazy, but making them cook food.
No, that's not crazy.
Yeah, that's actually something quite big, because we are the only species that I think on Earth that actually cook food.
Yeah.
It is an inherently human thing to do. And again, particularly in children's fiction, where food is incredibly important, to the extent that there will be actually publishers who are like, no, there's not enough food in this in this children's book. We need more food. And, you know, even thinking just about children's book in general, can you think of a children's book which doesn't have amazing food scenes, like feasts that they've got, you know, even, you know, Oliver Twist are technically not for children, but it centers around food, glorious food, you know what I mean? There's this center on food and it being either disgusting or mouth-watering. And so for children's books, when you have these animal characters, you will often see them eating things which are very, very nice, or you might go the total opposite way. But because we want to, in particular, if you want to be able to empathize with a character, if you say, right, we're following this cat throughout this cat's adventure, describing the cat catching and killing a rat and then eating it raw is probably going to distance the reader from the character just a tiny bit. Describing this character, this cat being served a platter of steaming cooked steak or something like that, is not going to have the same level of difference, and it's not going to jar readers so much. So, depending how you present these very human characteristics, again, of being clothed, of food, of the use of tools, it depends on the kind of story that you're telling. And usually, if there are no humans in that world, the humans will have been replaced with the animals who will have the role of being human or representing humanity. Whereas you're more likely to see less of that. There are humans that do technically exist within the society of this book.
Okay, so let's look at why you might decide to write a book that's entirely animals rather than other than just I really like animals. And there's three main reasons that I can think of, and maybe you can think of some more. First of all is that anthropomorphic animals used instead of humans are actually quite safe. We mentioned Animal Farm just now. There is a long history of animal characters being used to discuss political issues. Believe it or not, if you go back to ancient Greece and Aesop's Fables, almost all of Aesop's Fables were a discussion on the politics of the time. But it was much safer to say, oh, well, the crow and the fox were talking about this, rather than to say, so and so and so and so were discussing this, and I think this one's being stupid for this reason, and this one's being stupid for that reason. There is obviously the whole issue of freedom of speech back in ancient Greece, and you had to be. I mean, it sounds great, but you actually had to be a man of a certain class and at the appropriate time to be able to speak freely about a political issue. So it's not really as great as it sounds. Obviously, animals and politics, that's quite a good way of doing it. You get your message across, you're discussing the issues without actually pointing fingers. I mean, we could have an entire sort of let's have a look at the House of Lords and the House of Commons right now. In the middle of the clusterfuck that is Brexit, and make them all animals, and perhaps it would all be a bit more palatable, and people might even understand it better.
I think the other thing, of course, is that there's a certain level of protection from people turning around saying, hey, this is very obviously political satire. And you say, no, I am describing animal behaviours. Because there's ways that you can implement natural expectations and choose certain animals so that it will fit the narrative that you are trying to emulate.
Yeah, definitely. The second reason I came up with is that anthropomorphic animal characters, in fact, animals in general, particularly with children but also with adults, tend to capture an audience more readily on certain themes than humans do. I've always joked that I like animals more than people. It's actually not that much of a joke, to be honest. It's just merely a statement. But there are very few people who are kind of like, oh, I don't like animals. There's always that part of us that still wants to own a little piece of the wild that we've left behind. So, stories that feature animal protagonists are popular partly for that reason. People like animals. And the third one, I'm not sure how many people are going to agree with me on this one, but you can tell a much grittier story, particularly for younger readers, with animals as your protagonist rather than humans. I mean, if you want to think of, we'll go into it a bit more later, but Brian Jack's Red Wool series, some of those battle scenes are basically grimdark, that they're that strong, and yet you get away with it in books that are intended for 9-year-olds because they're animals. There's a separation there between you. On one hand, you've got the child really engaging with the character because it's an animal protagonist, and on the other, the child is not quite so distraught because it's not a human that's just died in that horrific battle scene. If
I
that
mean,
makes sense.
it literally does, and this is a phenomenon which is recorded and which has been used not just in literature but in films as well. Now, obviously, when you have the visual, add another level as well. But this seems like a deviation, but it's not. If you think of a cartoon, Samurai Jack, for instance, actually dealing with some very serious things that happen. But the way that they were able to get around a lot of the violence is that all of the in the first in the new recently rebooted one where they went full dark, but in the original from a few years, they were able to get away with the violence by making sure that everyone attacked Jack, who he destroyed, were robots.
Yeah.
So instead of blood and guts and things like that, they could just have oil spilling out, or just it wasn't quite the same. And it's a very similar principle when it's applied to fiction. Now, in fiction, you don't actually necessarily have to describe the gore. Of course, if there's gore when there's a visual element, you have to show it to a certain extent, but you don't have to show it in fiction. But you do still have to deal with that emotional fallout, which is just as real and just as dangerous. So you're absolutely right. Using animals allows both a connection for the reader, but also allows an appropriate level of distance
Yeah,
as well.
completely. Thinking back to, I think, yeah, no, I would have been 9, and the first one I read in the Redwall series was Mossflower, which is the prequel to Redwall. And just off the top of my head, and bearing in mind I haven't read that book in about 15 to 20 years, so it's been a while, that it deals with things like, it's got a very Shakespearean plot to start with. You've got the wildcats who are oppressing everyone else, and you've got the female wildcat daughter who intends to take over her father's kingdom, to the extent where she gets fed up of waiting, kind of bumps him off. They have mismanaged the kingdom really badly, and a lot of the other animals have sort of become refugees. So it's dealing with things like a refugee crisis, finding a new home. It deals with torture and imprisonment. It deals with basically a fa almost a fascist re regime, if you like, certainly a non-benevolent dictatorship. And there are some serious battle scenes in that as well. And then there is a character in there who's a spy, and it's not a case of, oh, ha ha ha, this is really funny, we've caught you. It's a case of, we've caught you, and now we're going to put you to death in a really horrific way. And yet it was all deemed appropriate for children because it wasn't people, it was animals, various different animals who, some of them wore clothes, some of them carried weapons, they kind of had opposable thumbs, they cooked food, as you said. So they're doing all these human things. They talk like humans. There are no humans in the background of this story at all. And yet you're getting away with what I've said, as I've said, some pretty grim, dark stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can get away with it. I think also a way that allows a certain level of violence is when injuries are done to parts of the anatomy that humans don't have.
Tails, for example.
Tails are an excellent, because that way you can create this level of hurt, but without it actually being too big for the reader as well. So the reader can go, oh gosh, they've had their tail cut off, that's awful. But if they, oh gosh, they've had their paw cut off, now let me think about having my hand cut off. Visually, it represents something that's a lot more shocking and striking because these are features that we. And it's about kind of finding that balance, really.
I think there was another component that I noticed looking back now with the Redwall books, and that was it stopped a lot of the argument about what role was appropriate for which gender. So, because when it became animals and you kept relative size and perspective, having the biggest, strongest animal be Bella, who is a badger, made sense. Or Zarmina, who was a wildcat, again made sense. And you've got lots of little mice who are, wield swords and tend to be like quite handy. I think we're supposed to think that while the badger and the wildcat are bigger, they're not so very much bigger than they would have been, and the mice are a little bit bigger than they were, etc. So you've sort of evened it out a little bit. But you've got the squirrel queen, Amber, for example, and the squirrels are all archers. And then you've got the otters who tend to be really good with slings. And there's Logalog the Shrew, who has an army of fierce shrew pike warriors and things. But it does, it leaps over the whole gender thing. And that was an issue kind of back in the 80s and early 90s. I think it's less now. You can have a lot more, you know, the men can sit and sew and the women can go out and go to war, etc. And it turns up more in children's books. But back then, it was kind of, that was a way of getting around it.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. It's amazing as well. I'm just going to talk about children's books again in particular with this subject, which is that children's books are often also trying to teach children how to empathize, yeah. And they're instructing children to empathize. And there's a two way. On the one side, actually, if a child associates too much with a character, they're not actually empathizing with that character. What they're doing instead is they're living vicariously through that character.
Yeah.
So actually, they're just really engaging their own, you know, their own self-preservation. If a character is relatable, but is just different enough, or has different elements which separate them, then actually by getting invested in their story, children are developing that level of empathy because they're looking at someone outside of them who still feels real and dynamic and, you know, multi-layered enough to be a real person or to be a real thing, but within the parameters that are safe. And so that is actually an engagement of empathy and helps to sort of stimulate, you know, that part of the development process in young kids. And using animals is the perfect way to do that, because you can get a character who, you can make a character who is lovable and who kids will care about, but who they won't necessarily be completely able to just insert themselves into. There's still these differences which will allow empathy rather than just.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. It's reminded me that in the younger junior fiction section of the library I work at, younger junior fiction is really for sort of 6 to 9 year olds, 5 to 8 year olds, depending on how precocious a reader a child is. There's an entire section of, I don't know, there's like 14, 15 of these books and more come out every year, of books that are produced by, but you know, the money goes back to the RSPCA basically. And they're obviously ghost written by a series of different writers, but they've got a very similar cover, and it's usually a kitten or a puppy or a goat or something like that with a very, very human look in its eyes. It's clearly an anthropomorphized, idealized version of an animal, but it looks like an animal. And it's things like Ginger the Stray Kitten and the kitten that got lost in the storm, and it is about this animal that, just looking at them, it's a short, a little book about an animal that's sort of been in sort of in dire straits and has been kind of rescued and taken care of by a human. And that is the basic plot for most of them. But kids love them. They absolutely love them because they empathise with the animal, as you say, but they see themselves as the rescuer, the person coming in and rescuing the animal.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is a great way of developing empathy and a great way of teaching behavior and kind behavior.
Yeah.
So using animals in children's books is a great way of doing that. Each era we have different things that we want to teach kids. You just look at the Victorian era and they were just like, we're going to teach kids that okay, I'm just thinking of some very bad morals that you get in general grim fairy tales, but you know, that they had stories which were all about manners and appropriate things. And now, of course, we in children's fiction, the thing that we tend to prioritize is kindness and empathy and curiosity and things like that. And again, animals, actually using animals in children's books can also develop curiosity depending how you're using them. In the case of that, there are books which are, as you know, sponsored by animal groups, animal activist groups, are trying to protect animals or spread information, who use literature, sometimes successfully, sometimes less successfully, to spread awareness about the issues which are facing endangered animals, and other things like that. And again, these are incredibly effective because you create this connection between humans and animals, whereby for the first time we are able to hear what animals are thinking or understand what they're saying or see the experience through their eyes.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, let's look at some examples. I would quite like to start with The Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham, partly because the title of this episode comes from the one chapter in that book that a lot of people don't know what to do with, as in they get all the, you know, they'll read Wind in the Willows and it's great. It's a story about Mole and Ratty and, you know, the curmudgeonly badger who lives in the woods and apparently is a bit crusty and doesn't really like visitors, but seems to really attach themselves to this group of found family. And the silly Mr. Toad who's always getting into scrapes. And yet then you've got this massive chapter where they're looking for a friend's lost child. They don't know what's happened to Small, and Small's just gone missing. And Mole and Ratty are looking everywhere, and the mother is frantic looking for this child as well. And all the animals are out looking everywhere. Has it gone into the woods? Have the weasels got it?
Yeah.
And finally, Mole and Rat are stumbling, tired, out into the dawn near the banks of the river. And they hear music. And as they walk further and further on into the sort of the rising mist, and it's a really visual chapter as well, they see what is basically the god of the animals. They see Pan playing his pan pipes, and he's sat by the bank of the river, and neither Rat nor Mole can actually think of a thing to say to this god who they didn't even really know existed. It's like an incredibly spiritual, overawing experience. And curled up asleep in the god's lap is Small, this lost animal. And he's just been playing his pipes and he's played the little child to sleep. And then when they look again, the god is gone, but they found the lost child. And none of them can ever talk about it afterwards. That's the really interesting thing. And it just resonates so strongly with me in the sense of someone who's really, truly had a spiritual experience and can never really put it into words because it's so intensely subjective. And it was such a strange thing to include in a book that is basically a children's adventure story about, you know, you've got to be a bit careful in how you interact with other people. There's all these great qualities that these main characters have and you should try to have all of them, but you bear in mind that you will steady each other, if you see what I mean. So it was weird to have something that was kind of like, yes, my son, there is religion out there, or rather there's faith out there, and it's not to be despised, but at the same time your focus shouldn't really be on it. And that was, it always fascinated me, is that as a chapter in the book.
Sounds like Christian propaganda to me, but no,
the fact it's a pagan god as well. Kind of like the personification of the natural world was there.
Yeah,
you've been living your little animal lives, and yet something out there is taking care of you.
And yeah.
Animals and religion—that was an interesting one.
Yeah. I always get the feeling, and this is probably entirely wrong, but who wrote it again?
Kenneth Graham.
Yeah. So I always get the feeling that as he started writing it, he was fully in. And he just wrote the first page and went, oh no. That was just it. It was just like, duh, 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 oh. Whoops.
Well, I mean,
and I have no idea where that idea came from, but I just see it so clearly in my head every time I think of The Wind in the Willows, which is just that he accidentally made it about animals.
Well, I think initially, from what I've read of the background, his son was quite difficult as a child. And quite recalcitrant in general, and he used to tell him these stories, and then gradually started writing those stories down. So, you know, a bit like Winnie the Pooh and various other things.
Mm.
And it came out of that, and I think from there it turned into not quite a morality tale, but an examination of human nature through these animal protagonists, which is part of what makes it so enduringly brilliant.
Yeah.
But one that's really interesting in that is that there are humans, and the humans are like driving their cars and living in their Edwardian houses and going about their human lives and things. And then you've got Toad at Toad Hall, who is possibly one of the wealthiest bachelors in the district, and he's a toad and does actually interact with humans and drive his own motor car and get into lots of trouble and get sent to a human prison for 100 years.
That's a very long time for a toad.
That's a very long time for a toad. And the bit with the trial, it's kind of, as a child, you're totally on his side, even though he's been really irresponsible and nearly killed someone with his motor car. But you're really, really on his side. And he's just not taking the entire process of due law and order at all seriously. And he calls a policeman pig face, you know, which is like ahead of its time in terms of the punk rock movement. And they sentence him to 6 months in prison for dangerous driving and 100 years for the cheek.
Oh, wow, that's...
Of course, he escapes rather like Bonnie Prince Charlie did, dressed and disguised as a washerwoman.
That's amazing.
So, yes, in some ways it's of its time, but I think it's still got a lot to say to a modern audience. In a completely different vein, talking roughly about animals and religion, and animals having their own little religion and beliefs and things, the Deptford Mice trilogy by Robin Jarvis. Obviously, I've said Robin Jarvis, so you know this is going to be horrific. But there's an interesting... there are kind of humans very much in the periphery of the Deptford Mice, as in the mice provide for themselves living in Deptford by stealing from the house next door where an old lady lives. And they actually just go into her larder and steal food. As you do. And that's how they live. But what's interesting is he actually says, and the mice worship the green spirit of the fields like humans once did. And this green spirit, which to the mice appears as the green mouse, made of sort of leaves and grass and graveyard mould as well, actually, is their god, and does take a part in these books, and it turns up on at least two occasions, but only Audrey, the main character, really ever sees him properly. And they have this idea of when a mouse comes of age, they get his or her mouse brass. And a mouse brass is like a little pendant, and you're supposed to pick the first one that your paw touches when you put it, your paw in the bag that contains the mouse brass.
Yeah.
And that will tell you what your destiny will be, and you wear it as kind of a talismanic thing.
Yeah.
And Audrey pulls out one, which is an anti-cat charm, which confuses the mouse brass maker because he didn't actually...
He didn't put it in there.
He didn't put it in there at all. I mean, they're supposed to go through this whole ceremony where they go through spring and summer into autumn and winter, and they face the fear and the dark and the cold and everything, and they come out the other side, and then they've reached their majority, their age of majority, their adult mice, and they get their mouse brass, etc. But it all goes a bit pear-shaped for poor Audrey, who's been marked out for a destiny that's tall and terrible in mouse language.
Yes.
And it sort of goes on from there. And the mice... their deadly enemies are the rats that live in the sewers. There is some really, really grim stuff in those books. I really love them to bits, but even reading them as sort of a 12-year-old, and the bit where they know that the rats will eat the mice. The rats will actually eat each other, and they talk about that in the books.
Okay.
There's a bit where two of the mice are down in the sewers because they've gone looking for Audrey's missing mouse brass. And they're trying to hide from the rats, and they find a rat's secret lair. And there's a whole bunch of mouse pelts on the floor, and they hide in the mouse pelts. And they're literally lying there, hidden, wrapped in dead mouse flesh, in dead mouse fur. And I'm like, at 12 and 13, I was kind of like, that's dreadful. My mind did not have difficulty crossing the divide there to, what if we tanned human hides and then you had to hide in a pile of them? Anyway, great books. I highly recommend them. And says a lot of intelligent stuff about bravery and compassion and about religious practices too. He goes on into the second book, and you've got a divide between the staunch green mouses. The staunch green mouses are basically Puritans. And the ones who like, well, I believe in the green mouse because, that's my religion, that's what I believe, but I believe he's also good, and there's room for lots of different things. We don't need to do harm in his name. And it's amazing that these books kind of got published with that in them in some respects.
Yeah.
And once again, animals have made it possible.
I do love the fact that you can just, Jules can turn around and just be like, yeah, so this book totally traumatized me. Anyway, it's great, and you should all read it. I do recommend that anything manages to traumatize or scare Jules should be taken with extreme care. Extreme care.
Well, I mean, I was 12 or 13 at the time. You can totally read them now, you'll be fine.
Extreme care, guys. Weirdly enough, I've realised that the books that we're going to talk about, we've talked about Redwall and Audrey. We tend to get a lot of books which centre around. And I actually want to talk about another one, which is a series of children's books written by Eve Titus, which are the Basil of Baker Street books.
Oh, is that what the Disney film is based on?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, the Great Mouse Detective was the Disney film, which are based on Basil of Baker, Baker Street, which is basically the mouse equivalent of Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
Except it's not that this is a society in a world of mice. They do actually live in the human world, where actually Basil literally lives in the basement of 221B Baker Street.
I love that.
Where Sherlock Holmes actually does exist.
I love
and
that.
And in the movie, they actually even borrow Sherlock.
Yes.
And Basil, he's a little bit different from Sherlock. And actually, in the movie, they made him more like Sherlock. In the books, he plays the flute rather than the violin.
Yeah.
But he... and his name is Basil. And he is named after Basil Rathbone, who was a very famous actor who played Sherlock. And rather than Dr. Watson, he has Dr. David Dawson.
Yeah.
And then there's Professor Padraic Ratigan, who's who's Moriarty, and Mrs. Judson rather than Mrs. Hudson. The great thing is that they are very obvious caricatures or very obvious parallels of Sherlock Holmes, except they live in the same world as Sherlock Holmes, and they're literally paralleling his actions and his general kind of character. I just think it's brilliant. And just talking about the movie, you see the movie and they're all dressed up in their smart little clothes, and there's a little mouse queen and all that jazz, and this is all happening at the same time as ordinary Victorian London.
Yeah.
So hilarious!
I didn't realise they were based off books, but I just, the film, I didn't see it for years and years, and I was like, this is really cool. This is so much fun.
It is. It is, yeah. And I love the way that that's done. And I think that, you know, there's a certain level of scrutiny that you can apply to and say, okay, but how does it work? But I think because it is aimed at children, you don't need to. You just accept that, yeah, okay. Literally this rat society in this human world, and humans just literally haven't noticed that rats wear that mice and rats wear clothes. And
yeah, well, that kind of makes sense in a way, I suppose, because, you know, it's the whole Umwelt thing again, isn't it? You know, humans are stuck in their own perspective, their own selfish view of the world, and the mice are stuck in theirs.
Except very interestingly, at least within the films, They are all mice. I think even Ratigan is actually a mouse as well. In the film, he's depicted as being quite rat-like, but he is, in the books, he is a mouse. But they do end up interacting with other animals. But these other animals behave as in the way that we would expect animals to behave. So, for instance, Basil and Dr. Dawson both kind of commandeer this dog to help them track someone down. And the dog cannot speak. The dog does not communicate. The dog is just a dog. And so it seems to be that there's no other real, and maybe there's a talking bird at one point. I'm not sure. I don't think so. But I'm almost certain the other anthropomorphic animals are the mice. They are the only ones who are human in any way, and every other animal behaves in a typical animal fashion.
While we're on the subject of mice, let's talk about Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim, which became a film in the 80s called The Secret of Nim. And the book's by Robert C. O'Brien. The book is probably a lot superior to the film, although the film's pretty damn good, as I recall. And there are humans, again, on the periphery, and humans kind of cause the initial problem. Mrs. Frisbee lives with her children in basically a hollowed out brick at the bottom of a farmer's field. Every year they move to their spring home, only this year they can't move because her youngest son Timothy has got pneumonia, which means if they move him, he'll die. So that's a very human conflict, but obviously using animals. And she needs to find a way of actually moving the brick that they live in, which you'd think would be impossible for a mouse, really. And it needs to be done before they plow the field, because if the field gets plowed while they're still in the brick, they will all die. And so she goes to see her husband got caught a while back in a mouse trap and died. So she's widowed. She goes off to see Mr. Ages. Mr. Ages sort of sends her off to speak to the rats, which you'd think that would kind of end one way, but Mr. Ages, who's known her husband for a very long time, says, "Oh no, the rats owe him a favor." And she goes down, and basically what you find out is that the rats who live on this farm and her husband Jonathan Frisby and Mr. Ages were all part of a scientific experiment whereby they were testing different injections on rats and mice to see if they could make them more intelligent. This they did actually The humans did actually manage to make them more intelligent. You never really see humans in the film. I think you see humans only as kind of like a pair of hands or something here and there. And they became intelligent enough that they were able to read the signs on their cages, so saying things like lift latch in order to open cage, and they realized how they could get out. But the rats couldn't actually open the cages themselves. They couldn't get their paws through. So Jonathan Frisby had actually managed to open the cages for the rats and then help them all through the grating when they get out. So the rats owe him this huge debt of gratitude, even though he's dead, and they'll pass that onto his widow. And the rats actually work out a way of doing a pulley and tackle system to lift the brick so that they can physically move the brick out of the field before it gets ploughed, with Timothy still inside. It's a really, really great book, and think about it, the rats are using not only the reading, they're using algebra and things. And it's really noticeable that the main rat says, "Well, can you read?" to Mrs. Frisbee, and she said, "No, I found it really difficult to pick it up. Jonathan tried to teach me. My children can read, though. They picked it up from him quite easily." So clearly this thing that changed in the rats and the mice got passed on to his children as well. So you've got this group of like super intelligent rats and super intelligent rat mice who are living on a human farm.
That's really cool.
And there's kind of like a mystical, magical thing in there as well, which I won't go into in case it spoilifies it. But I thought it was a really, it's quite heart-wrenching in a way. It's a really interesting look at grief and motherhood and the length someone will go to for someone they love. I mean, she's literally going up against godlike forces, because that's what humans may as well be to mice. So she's going up against all these things in order to save her son. And that's a very, very human story to tell with animals.
It is. And it is a particularly human story, because even though with animals, we see amazing displays of motherhood and parenthood, there is also a very practical side to it, which is that animals will abandon young, even kill their own young and eat them, if they feel that there is too much of a threat.
Yeah.
Because, of course, the thing that matters is that the mother stays alive in order to breed again.
Yes.
The emphasis is less on underdeveloped children. So, yeah, we do see these amazing displays of motherhood in nature, but we also see things with less, less yeah. so. So to have a story which is about that, that is very human. And yeah. it's also very relatable. What is it about mice, Jules?
I think it's the kind of the Hobbit paradox, whereby you take the smallest and the weakest and you make them triumphant, because when you do that, then anybody can be.
I think you're right. There's an element of the fact that anthropomorphically, it's actually quite easy to put ourselves into mammals. And mice in particular.
Yeah.
Are quite good with that, because yeah, okay, they have tails, but actually they have most of the kind of little features that we do, and they have little grabby hands.
They do. I mean, you can even see a mouse holding a crumb of cheese. It's really cute. Most rodents do have the rotating wrists, so
yeah, exactly. And you know, that's something that the cats and dogs don't have. But yeah, squirrels. Swirls, mice, even otters.
Yeah.
Yeah, animals like that, which have hands and which, you know, have kind of the ability technically to use tools in some way or another, or to carry things or to move around with them, I think are also very easy to use as humans. Because it's very difficult to talk about a dog holding a sword, for instance. Whereas you can kind of imagine a mouse yeah. holding a sword. You could put a sword in, not a full-sized one, probably, but a tiny sword. I say probably. Like, no, actually a full sword is not something a mouse could conceivably hold. But like a little sword made out of a toothpick, you could give that to a mouse. It could hold it.
Yeah, totally. Okay, there's two last examples I want to talk about, and they're very, very different. The first one is Watership Down by Richard Adams. Obviously, we weren't going to get to an anthropomorphic animal episode without talking about one of my favourite books.
Yeah, we couldn't really avoid this.
I won't go into the gruesome stuff, but what I will say about Watership Down, that what's interesting about Watership Down is that it's low on the anthropomorphism, as in they're anthropomorphised in the sense of they're kind of given quite human motivations. However, those motivations are presented through a very, very rabbit perspective. So they don't walk on hind legs or anything. And the only real that it talks about, you know, how rabbits live in great detail. So the fact that they prefer to come out and graze at sunset and sunrise, how rabbits will fight against each other. I mean, everyone thinks rabbits are cute, but actually they're vicious little bastards. They really are. You put two male rabbits in close confines together, and come mating season, they will castrate each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, when they fight, it's really, really vicious. So an overcrowded warren is a very, very bad thing. And the fact it talks about the fact that the female rabbits, if you stress them out, they will eat their own litters. And there's various other interesting bits about rabbit biology and things there. It talks about them chewing their pellets. As we all know, rabbits re-ingest their poo, so they get more nutrients out of it. So there's all that. And yet you have this group of rabbits who leave the Sandalford Warren because one of them has had a vision of something bad coming to the Sandalford Warren. So it's kind of like the outsiders, the yearlings, who all band together. And again, this is all about friendship and found family again, in a weirdly dystopian sort of rabbit type setting. And they go through all sorts of trials and things until they manage to win a warren for themselves. And then they face the other problem. And the other problem is that they have no does with them, because does generally are accepted into a warren no matter what, because you can always find room for another breeding doe. So they end up finding another warren, which is obviously Ephrafa, the woundwort's warren, which is kind of in a very communist type with the dictatorship rabbit as the chieftain at the top. And there's a grand plan to steal a bunch of does from there, the ones who are willing to come with them, to come and live in their new warren, the nut hanger.
Yeah.
I'm not really doing it justice talking about it, but the sheer skill of making those two things, the very, very rabbit perspective and yet an understandable human motivation behind it, marry together in the way that Richard Adams has, was just a feat of genius, really.
Yeah.
And at its heart, it is a story about friendship and about a band of misfits coming together and creating something that's quite visionary, and all learning to play off each other's strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah. The interesting thing about it is that a book like that the story can conceivably exist, in that we could say, wow, maybe that's actually, I mean, it isn't, but maybe that's actually what life is like for a rabbit.
Yeah.
Because they don't really do anything, you know, biologically impossible. They're not wearing clothes, as you say. They behave as rabbits do behave. So there's an educational side to that. Not that I think Watership Down is really meant to be educational in that way, but it is educational. And it is, in the same way that Harry Potter works, the part of what makes it so real and vivid is the fact that we could say, wow, this is happening right now. And the reason we don't know about it is because of all of these wizard laws. And so it feels real. And Watership Down is the same. We can say, wow, this is happening right now. These are real characters, which is attractive in a different way to things like Red Wall, where there are no humans, and Basil of Baker Street, where there are, but they're very, very separate entities.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, final example, and this is just going to be very quick because I haven't watched it in a very long time, but I want to mention it because it just shows you the scope of what you can do with an anthropomorphic animal story, and that's the series Bucky O'Hare.
Bucky O'Hare!
I have a lot of affection for that. Yes, there is one human main character, and I think he was included as kind of an access point. But all the other main characters, all the other characters, in fact, are animals. Anthropomorphic animals in a sci-fi universe where they're battling against the evil empire, and Bucky O'Hare's ship is just made up of this composite of very different types of characters. I mean, you've got Deadeye Duck. You've got Jenny the psychic cat.
I mean, Jules, is this where your love of space cowboys comes from?
I don't know, possibly. It's certainly, no, I think that comes from Han Solo, but Bucky O'Hare is definitely a close second. And he's just, he's a green rabbit, okay?
Looking back at it now, it's kind of freaky.
Looking back at it, I mean, I'd love to have been a fly on the wall for whoever pitched that, because I feel like somebody didn't do their homework and they all came into a meeting and someone said, go, pitch your ideas at me. And this person was kind of like, what if we had a green space rabbit? I'm like, go on. And there's a psychic cat woman. She comes from a race of psychic cat people, but it's all super secret. I'm listening. And a duck with four arms, but he's like, a crack shot.
Okay, because I think it was originally a comic book series.
It probably was,
and then became a TV series. I'm almost certain that there must have been a Japanese influence in there somewhere.
It feels like there should have been.
It definitely does. So I'm almost certain. But maybe not. It says I'm just looking at, so publisher originally was Continuity Comics. First appearance Echo of Future Past one, created by Lara Hammer and Michael Golden. So
Cool.
there you go. Very odd, but also, yeah, I do remember Biohair.
So you literally can do pretty much anything with a group of anthropomorphic animals. And there are books we haven't talked about. We haven't talked about Midnight Sun by Gary Kilworth, which is for adults, or Duncton Wood, which is about moles, again, which is for adults. And there's loads of others. There's the Dorset Squirrels. There's the one about the dolphin that comes up in Dingle Bay in Ireland. And
There's Finding Nemo, if we're looking at some of the, the visual media. It is quite interesting because for the most part, I think the stories tend to be dominated by mammals. But we have started to play around with that. And of course, Robin Hood. I had to say
Yes.
it, Jules.
You
I
had to
know
talk about the fox.
we've spoken about Robin Hood recently, obviously, but that was just in relation to the fox. I do remember, and weirdly enough, I've had this conversation with several people where we were trying to remember exactly how many different animals there were in Robin Hood, and literally the same conversation with about two or three people who just went, "Oh, but I thought, all of the animals were British animals." And
No,
then we both
we don't
stopped
have
and went, "We don't have lions and rhinos or hyenas."
or
Or
tortoises.
tortoises and like or vultures, and the more we thought about it, we were like, "My God, this is we don't really even have bears."
Not anymore.
Not
I mean,
anymore.
you could argue we probably did
We
back then,
did
but
then, yeah, but it's just the fact that we just what we were like, yeah, no, wait, and then just continue to list them, and it just goes on and on.
that's
But yeah,
cracking.
that's an example of. Just humans, but they just happen to be animals. And I think it is the case that it just it does allow a certain level of separation. Actually, also, I think another thing which is quite nice about it is because of the difference in proportion, facial features, and things like that, you can actually bring out characteristics or expressions in a more unique and obvious way than if you were doing humans as well.
Yeah, well, for example, having a little John be a bear, and then you've got
Yeah.
Robin Hood as a fox.
As a fox. Yeah, there's a real visual element there which goes even beyond just their size. It says a lot about them. So,
That's another one of those things where I feel that someone is having far too much fun with their work,
yeah.
and I'm kind of like, no, that's not work. You're enjoying yourself too much.
You're not
I'm a
allowed
bit
to enjoy
jealous.
it this much.
And I think we'd better call it a day there.
I think we better head. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. Now, this week, I was actually going to recommend something else, but I'm not going to do it now. Instead, I am going to recommend that everybody who's listening go and watch The Great Mouse Detective, because it is so good, and it's an old film now. It is definitely an old film, but it is just so charming, and it's wonderful, and yeah, I mean, it was released in 1986, so it's definitely not new. It's older than I am, but definitely worth watching, so I really, really, really do recommend it to everybody.
Okay, thanks for that.
And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks, goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.